we're not certainly not going to get to all of it. It kind of grew on me as things progressed. But. All right, we've got Jonathan by phone. Because he couldn't make it, so he's here long distance. How are you? The source pages are up here on the. There's a source booklet and a single page. All right. Let's jump in. The basic question that I want to explore in this context, talk about Hanukkah. We talk about Hanukkah a lot every year. It comes up, drushes and shiurim, etc. And typically our conversations around Hanukkah revolve around the miracle of the oil, story of the Greek conquests, or liberation of Israel. They revolve around questions of 8 days versus 7 days, the significance of 8 days, sort of the typical or the classical questions that relate to Hanukkah. What I want to explore tonight is what I've entitled the shiur, A Fresh Look at the Spiritual and Political Legacy of Hanukkah, or Hanukkah and Yom HaAtzmaut. Hanukkah and Yom HaAtzmaut is actually a connection to a shiur that I gave about 10 years ago. That is not the shiur for tonight, so we're not repeating that shiur yet. Eventually we will. But there is a connection, and we'll draw the link at the end. But what I really want to explore is what I threw out on Shabbos morning in my drasha as a kind of a subject of a drasha, meaning a 5-minute, 7-minute piece. But it was a little bit of a bombshell if you really processed what it was that I was throwing out there. And so I decided that let's flesh it out and let's explore it in more detail. And that's the Rambam's take on Hanukkah and why it's unique. And what we can learn from the suggestion that the Rambam makes that really is a remarkable change, a remarkable twist in how we perceive the events of Hanukkah and the impact that Hanukkah has really till today. So by that introduction, we're going to actually start with, you should all have two source pages. You should have a booklet that has about 7 pages. We might get to 2 or 3 of them. And you should have a page in color, which is the PowerPoint we're about to explore that together. Classically, our story of Hanukkah, if you will, or our mitzvah of Hanukkah, the candle lighting and everything relating to Hanukkah as we understand it, basically comes from a single passage in the Talmud in Masechet Shabbat, which gets quoted a lot, and we should be familiar with it. You have it in two places. You have it on the source page in source 1. I'll get to the color page in a moment, but the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat states the following. I added one paragraph at the beginning, a kind of intro paragraph, and it's relevant. You'll see why in a moment. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, Mitzvah lahanicha al petach beito mi bachutz. The mitzvah of putting the candles is on the entrance to the house facing the outside. That's the mitzvah. If you're living on a second story, then manicho b'chalon hasmucha l'rishut harabim, then you put it in a window. Because you're not on the ground floor, you're not at the entrance of the house. U'bishat ha-sakana manicha al shulchano v'dayo. If it's a time of danger, sakana, then you place the menorah on the table, and that's sufficient. What is a time of danger?
Anti-Semitism,
war. Why is that relevant to where you put the Hanukkah candles? Say that again. So flesh that out. Meaning what?
Well, the people from the outside looking in aren't going to say, "Hey, there's something that's Jewish."
Right. So why is it at a time of danger? Would you want to put the candles on the inside and not on the outside?
You don't want to tell your enemies where you are.
You don't want to tell your enemies where you are, either because you're hiding, right? You don't want them to identify there's a person living there or a Jewish person living there. There's a concern about possibility of anti-Semitism, right? We understand what Shabbat Sakana is. And essentially, it's from that halacha that for generations, I would say almost centuries, the practice was to put the Hanukkah lights inside the house. Over the course of later generations, particularly in America, we put them by the window so that we kind of have some element of external reflection of the lights. In Israel, on the other hand, they put them outside the house, literally, because that's what the halacha says. Yeah?
Should you also remove your mezuzah?
Remove the mezuzah?
In times of danger.
Oh, okay, so that's a good question, right? Times of danger, you're going to remove the mezuzah. That would be a dangerous thing to do, because the mezuzah is supposed to protect us. So clearly, you don't want to do that. But that's a good question. Why is Hanukkah different? Right? We don't remove the mezuzah at a time of danger. Why would we... why would we move the Hanukkah candles? So I would say there's two answers to that question. Number one, because a mezuzah is deraisa and Hanukkah is derabanan, so you can. We can be more lenient with Hanukkah candles than we can with the mezuzah, because it's a derabanan. And the second is that we have an alternative. We don't have an alternative with the mezuzah, because the mezuzah has to be on your doorpost. Whereas we have an alternative with the Hanukkah candles, which is designed to publicize a miracle, so we can put it inside and publicize the miracle, not quite as well, but almost. However, what's fascinating about this halacha is a Rashi that, for some reason, doesn't get enough press. Rashi on that statement in the Gemara. Rashi says, what is the sakana, what is the danger we're talking about? Shehaya lehem leparsiim chok b'yom edam, shelo yavi'iru ner ela bebeit avodah zarah shelahem, kedaminim begitin. Says the sakana here had to do with a practice of the Persians, or the regional context in which Persians, Babylonians, it's unclear to Rashi whether that's a censored terminology, but in all cases we're talking about a practice that existed in the time of the Jewish community in Bavel, says Rashi, where the local population had certain ritual rules related to fire, and they were particularly concerned about lighting candles or lighting fires outside of the houses of idolatry, and therefore to light the candle was considered an act of insult, if you will, to the religious sensibilities of the Persian or Babylonian communities in which people live, and so we didn't do it. So it's interesting that there's an entire ritual related to fire that's specifically related to candles and fire to which this halacha was addressed. That's not the relevant issue, then maybe we should put the candles back outside. Not a subject halachic we're going to explore today, but just an interesting observation. Yes, sir?
Two quick questions. The first one is this a reference to the Zoroastrian belief?
Maybe.
Okay. The second question is this potentially a censored reference to Nitalnach?
To?
Nitalnach. The question that some people on the December 25th, they say you shouldn't read Torah because you shouldn't have any candles.
Yeah, I think that's a European, I think that's a much later European practice. I don't think Rashi would have put it into that context. I would have to explore that, but I don't think so. I think your first suggestion probably is closer to this issue, but in all cases, just interesting that the sakana here we were talking about is not necessarily what we would perceive as sakana, but to Rashi, it was some kind of ritual related to religious practices related to fire that was part of the arena, and here we are lighting a candle representing a miracle of fire in an environment where they worship fire, or where fire or light was particularly sensitive to these concerns, and so we didn't want to do that in public because it was an insult to the local population. So just fascinating. I think it's a very interesting segue into the next piece of the Gemara, because it's immediately upon the heels of this halacha about the danger, quote-unquote, of says Rashi, of this Persian culture of fire, that we ask the question, my Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah about? And that's where our story picks up. My Hanukkah, says the Gemara, the Tanna Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, in this passage I'm sure you've heard many times, there are 8 days of Hanukkah. This is a quote from a work called Masechet Ta'anit, the list of all the fast days of the Second Temple period. 8 days in which we don't fast, in which we don't eulogize, 8 days in which we don't say Tachanun, 8 days of celebration. And then the Braita explains why. I'm going to read this carefully and slowly. When the Greeks entered the temple, Tihtimu kol hashmanim shebeichal, they defiled all of the oil in the heichal, in the temple. Ukeshegavram malchut bet chashmonai, when the house of the kingdom of the chashmonaim were victorious, were strengthened and prevailed, v'nitzchum, and were victorious, badku v'lo matzu al hapach achad shel shemen sheyemunach b'chotamo shel kohen ha'gadol. They looked and they found only one flask of oil sealed with the seal of the high priest. V'lo haya bo le'adlik le'yom achad, there was not enough oil to light more than one day. Na sabones, miracle occurred. V'hidliku mimenu shmona yamim, and they lit from it 8 days long. Another year, or a following year, or another time, they appointed a festival, the recitation of Hallel and Thanksgiving. So a couple of observations about this passage before we move on very quickly. Number one, parenthetical to my shiur tonight, this is not the subject. I just want to make an observation to us all, because something that hit me for the very first time this week. So I got very excited about it. The miracle of the oil. How can we call it the miracle of the oil and not the miracle of the candles or the miracle of the fire? They lit the candles. The candles, what's the miracle? In a nutshell, what's the miracle?
The oil lasted 8 days.
Meaning? Give me the picture. What happened?
Just the oil and it like multiplied?
Either they lit and the fire didn't go out, or they kept pouring out of the jug and they kept getting oil in the jug.
Either they lit and it didn't go out for 8 days, or they kept they poured the oil into the menorah, and then the next day they came back and there was more oil in the jug. So is the miracle in the fire, in the candle, in the menorah, or is the miracle in the jug? Well, you tell me. Look at the passage. What does the Gemara say?
Hidliku
mimenu shmona yamim. From it they lit for 8 days. So, interesting question, and it never really hit me until this week for some reason, that if the miracle was in the jug, meaning the oil just never ran out, then that is not an unprecedented miracle. That is a story that appears in Tanakh twice. Eliyahu and Elisha with the oil. And suddenly, the miracle of Hanukkah is not so unique. It's happened before, but it's not about the light lasting for 8 days. It's about the oil in the jug lasting for 8 days. A whole different story, and that really could be the interesting subject for another year. So I'm parking that one for next year, because it's just fascinating to me. Sort of kind of hit that connection hit me for the first time this year, and I thought, okay, worthy of note. The other piece about this is that if you start to explore the focus of this passage, it's conspicuous by what it mentions and by what it doesn't mention. Okay, so what does it mention? It talks about the miracle. What's the miracle?
That we were able to... Depends on how you feel.
Okay, but whatever the miracle is, in general terms, what's the miracle?
We're able to win back the Beit HaMikdash.
And that is not what it says.
No, this,
what does it say is the miracle?
The oil burned for
8 days. 8 days of burning oil, and therefore there was a miracle of 8 days of oil, of 8 days of light, whatever, light or oil. But there's nothing here that's other than a miracle of the oil. Or maybe that they found the oil. Famous question of the Beit Yosef, is it a 7-day miracle, is it an 8-day miracle? Also a subject of discussion at length and not going to occupy tonight's conversation. But in all cases, that's the conversation. It's about the Pach HaShemen, the finding of the oil. What's the background? What's the historical background? What's the context that drives this conversation?
The war with Maccabees against the...
Again, just what's written here.
But it says,
Gavra Machut Beit Chashmonai. It says, Ki Shekavra Machut Beit Chashmonai V'nitzchum Badku. Right? by the way, when did this all happen? It happened when the Beit Hashmonai were able to get into the temple, right? So they are mentioned, the Hashmonaim and the Beit Hashmonaim are mentioned, but they're certainly not the focus of the conversation.
That all the oil was tameh.
Right? Well, the focus of the conversation is that the oil was tameh. The historical background is they needed to light the menorah, but they couldn't. Actually, in the Gemara, it seems to be the historical background is this shat sakana, this Persian practice of lighting, of ritual related to fire that Rashi points out. Maybe that's related to the issue. But there is, how much emphasis is there, how many column inches, how much focus is there in this passage over the story of the Hellenization, the struggle with the Syrian Greeks, the story of Antiochus, any of the conversations that are relevant to the story as it appears in the Book of the Maccabees? Virtually none. Virtually none. In fact, the Book of the Maccabees mentions everything else about the story of Hanukkah, doesn't mention the miracle of the oil. That's an obstacle, a challenge that we need to look at some point as well. Furthermore, let's take one step further. What about the Kohanim? What role do the Kohanim play? We know the story of Hanukkah is led by a family of Kohanim, correct? Matityahu, Kohen Gadol, etc. What role do the Kohanim play in this passage?
They
seal the oil. The Kohanim seal the oil. That's their role. They looked and they found one flask of oil with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. So if I had to ask you based on this passage alone, what role did the Kohen Gadol play in the story of Hanukkah? Unless you knew that the Beit Hashmonaim were a group of Kohanim, which it doesn't say, unless you knew that already, then the only role Kohanim have in this story is to certify the oil.
So I haven't certified that beforehand.
Correct.
In here, there's
almost no role. It's an older role than that.
Right.
So what I want to show you is, what I want to try to trace are three different versions of the story of Hanukkah, and in particular, my focus is on the Rambam for tonight, but we're going to start with this passage in the Gemara. And so I want to look at it from the perspective of these variables. What's the nature of the miracle? This is, you have this on the colored sheet. I've just put it on the screen for a second. What's the nature of the miracle? What's the historical background that is emphasized in this context? What is the mitzuka? What's the challenge that the Jewish people are facing with? In this passage, what challenge are the Jewish people faced with?
Finding enough oil.
In the story, they're not faced with the challenge of fighting the Greeks, because that's over. They're done, right? They were victorious. In this passage, the story of Hanukkah is about the challenge of finding the right amount of oil and role of the Kohanim in this regard. And so this is the story this is the Gemara that we just read. And what you have here is a highlight of the phrases, which we'll come to as the story progresses, but I want to look at it from the perspective of these variables. And what we've suggested so far is that the miracle of the oil is the primary miracle focused here in the Gemara. The background, that the Jews are lighting they need to light the menorah in the temple, that seems to be the focus of their issue. Maybe there's some connection to the Persian religious practices related to fire, Zoroastrianism, possibly. We don't know. The challenge that they have is that all of the oil in the temple is defiled by the Greeks. And the role of the Kohanim is to certify the oil, which is a very limited role in the context of the story of Hanukkah. So while the Gemara clearly focuses on the miracle that drives the mitzvah, and that's how most of the Mefarshim understand this passage, that the Gemara's question, my Hanukkah, is about what it is, which aspect of Hanukkah drives the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles, and the aspect of Hanukkah that drives the mitzvah that informs the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles is clearly the menorah lighting or miracle. There's no record, there's no connection between the mitzvah of lighting the candles and the war with the Syrian Greeks. There's no connection there. But there is, nonetheless, the question of my Hanukkah is essentially a question of what mitzvah establishes the nature of this chag. That's how the first passage is understood. This passage is in what we call the Babylonian Talmud. Now, there is another version of Hanukkah, or the other version that appears in our literature related to Hanukkah is, of course, the version that we speak of when we recite our Shemoneh Esrei, the version of Al HaNisim. It's a fascinating question where Al HaNisim comes from. And I share this with you because Al HaNisim is not mentioned anywhere in the Gemara. There's no reference anywhere in the Talmud Bavli to the prayer of Al HaNisim or even of the requirement to add a prayer to the Shemoneh Esrei. So where does it come from? So now put this aside for a second and go back to your source pages.
Is there something for Al HaNisim performed?
Yes. No, in the Gemara, no.
In the Gemara?
No. The same source for Al HaNisim for Hanukkah is the same source for Al HaNisim for
Hanukkah. There's Mahalal.
Halal is a different issue. There's a mitzvah halal on Hanukkah in the Gemara too.
Right, I'm saying it's in the Gemara.
Yeah, halal is in the Gemara, but not Al HaNisim. And that's a bit of a mystery. However, the earliest source we have for Al HaNisim comes from a work called Masechet Sofrim. Masechet Sofrim, you need to know a little bit of the historical background. Masechet Sofrim is part of a series of tractates referred to as the small tractates, the minor tractates, the Masechtot Ketanot. They appear in the back of a Gemara, but they're not in the Gemara itself. They're not dated from the time of the Talmud. They are most likely collected. It's unclear when they date from. Some suggest as early as the 6th or 7th century. I've heard 8th century. It's more likely. They are a bridge work between the time of the Talmud and the time of the Gaonim, post-Talmud. But it's written in Eretz Yisrael. How do I know it's written in Eretz Yisrael? Unlike the Talmud, which is written in Babylon.
Because it's not in that, it's not a part of that Talmud.
Well, number one, and number two, because it's written entirely in Hebrew.
That's what I was thinking.
That's a good one. Okay. Mishnaic work, Tanaitic work is written in Hebrew, Amoraic work, Talmudic conversation is written in Aramaic, and Masechet Sofrim is entirely in Hebrew. It's probably a brighter of an earlier source. And it's attributed typically to the community in Israel. In other words, it's contemporary to the Talmud, maybe a little bit later, but it is Israel-centered and not Babylonian-centered, Yerushalmi-centered, if you will. Right. Why is the geography of any relevance? Because we have a lot of traditions that appear in the Bavli and not in the Yerushalmi, and some that appear in the Yerushalmi and then are not in the Bavli. We have two basic traditions of halacha that we are aware of, and we have a couple of works in Halacha and the Rishonim that love to try to bridge the two. And one of them, classically, was the Rambam. And we, tonight, are studying the Rambam's view on Hanukkah. And so the bridge between the Bavli and the Eretz Yisrael work of the Yerushalmi, in this case, the Masechet Sofrim, is fascinating to me because it's really a beautiful example of where the Rambam drew from two traditions and kind of synthesized them together. And that's what we're going to look at. So Masechet Sofrim, the actual quote, appears in source 3, which is a chart on the bottom of the page, on page, back on the black and white source page. On the right-hand side, it doesn't say a lot. It's very short. And what it says is as follows. V'omrim b'hodaya. We recite the following in the blessing of Thanksgiving. What blessing is Thanksgiving? Not the holiday of Thanksgiving, the blessing of Thanksgiving?
Modim.
Right. This is what we say in Modim. We say the following. Ukenisei plaot utshuot kohanecha asher asita b'yemei Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai uvanav, in accordance with the miracles and the wonders and the victories that you gave to the Kohanim, your Kohanim, in the days of Matityahu ben Yochanan the high priest, Chashmonai and his children. In Similarly, Cain, Ase imanu Hashem Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu, Nisim v'Niflaot. So should you do miracles and wonders for us in the same way. Asa Nisim l'Avoteinu by Mimehem Bezman is that type of relation. V'nodeli shimcha lenetzach. We will thank you for eternity. Baruch ata Hashem, hatov, or hatov v'hametiv. Blessed are God who is good and who does miracles for his people. That's the bracha, that's the tefillah in Masechet Sofrim. So there are certain characteristics of this tefillah that are very important. They're fundamentally different than the passage in the Talmud Bavli. Namely, what's here that's not in the Gemara and Shabbos? What's in the Gemara and Shabbos that's not here?
This one talks about the shuot of the Chashmonaim.
So here we're talking about the shuot of the Chashmonaim, the victories of the Chashmonaim against, ostensibly against the Greeks. What else?
Mention the oil at all.
There's no mention, not only is there no mention of the oil, there's not even a mention of lighting the candles of the menorah. We're going to see that in our version of Al-Anisim, there's at least a reference to the lighting of the candles. But they don't even have, but they certainly don't have the miracle of the oil, certainly not a reference to the lighting of the, and not even a reference to the lighting of the candles. What else is either here or not here? One of the key phrases in this source, which will become the anchor of virtually every reference to Hanukkah subsequently.
There's the Nisim,
v'niflaot v'alatshuot, right? You have that nusach, that language that will eventually become ala Nisim, ala Niflaot, v'alatshuot, v'alamuchamot, etc., right? That introduction to ala Nisim, you have that, so that language is here. What else is here? How do both Chanukah and Purim's Al-Nisim begin, besides the introductory phrase, Al-Nisim, Al-Nisim, etc.
Bimei.
Okay? Time frame. What's the time frame here, and what's the time frame in the Talmud? In the Talmud Bavli, there's no time frame. It doesn't say any days of who. That just says, Beit Chashmonayu Vanav, there's a victory. When they were victorious, they went and they lit a 25th of Kislev, they lit the oil and it lasted 8 days. What's the time frame here for the story of the victories or the battles with the Greeks?
B'imei
Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai uvanav. We have a direct reference to the Kohen Gadol, direct reference to Matityahu HaMakabi. We have a direct to Yehuda Makabi. We have a direct Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai uvanav. We have a direct reference to the phraseology from which our version of Al-Nisim will grow. You see it? Now, shift your eye one column over, and what you have in the next column is the full text of Al-Nisim as it appears in the Siddur of Rav Amram Gaon, which is one of the earliest Siddur texts we have. Now we're going a century or two later, we're into the period of the Gaonim, but we're still pre all the Rishonim, pre Rashi, pre Rambam, early work. Siddur, he wrote a Siddur, he wrote a halachas of the Siddur, and he wrote a text that goes through the whole davening, and he fleshes out there the full text of Al-Nisim as we are familiar with it, more or less. Minor changes, but more or less the text is as we have it. Al-Nisim ve'ala gvot ve'ala tshuot ve'ala mechamot ve'ala pedut ve'ala purkan. A couple of extra words there about redemption that we don't have in our text, but more or less it's the same. It starts with exactly the reference to in the days of Matityahu, son of Yochanan, Kohen Gadol, the Chashmonai and his children. When the wicked kingdom of Yavan stood against your people Israel, lishakham mitaratecha, to cause them to forget your Torah, ulahaviram michukeretzanecha, and to bring them and to cause them to transgress against the laws of your will. Atabrachamecha rabim amadata laem beetzaratam, you in your great compassion stood by them in their time of distress. Ravte et rivam, you fought their battles. Dante et dinam, you judged their cause. Nakamtat nikmatam, you avenged their vengeance. Masarta gibarim biad chalashim, verabim biad ma'atim, verashaim biad tzadikim, tmeim biad tohorim. You gave over the mighty in the hands of the weak, the many in the hands of the few, the wicked to the hands of the righteous, the impure in the hands of the pure, zedim biad oskei toratecha, those wanton sinners into the hands of those who follow your Torah. Ulecha asis Hashem gadol yakadosh biolamecha, and you created a great sanctification of your name in the world. And you brought about a great redemption for Israel on this day. Then your children came into the sanctuary. They purified your sanctuary, they cleaned it up. They lit candles in the courtyard of your sanctuary. And fixed 8 days to celebrate in your great name. As you did miracles for them, so too shall you do miracles for us. Essentially, this source of the Alanisim is a fleshed out version of both our Alanisim as well as some of the pieces from the Sechet Sofrim, where he talks about just as you did miracles for them, so too you should do miracles for us, sort of that link into, it's not just about us saying thanks, it's actually a tefillah that Hashem should continue to bring about redemption and save us. Okay. So does everybody see the difference between this Alanisim and the Gemara and Shabbos with which we started?
Big difference.
Right? Huge difference, right? So, if we come back to our discussion, right, this is now, I've just shifted over a little bit, this is our version of Alanisim. It's a little bit different than the Amungo's version. More or less, it's the same themes. And what you find here is that if we go through the same variables, suddenly their emphasis is completely different. First of all, there's no reference to the miracle of the oil. We do have a reference to lighting candles. Correct? But it's by the by. They rebuilt the temple, and they purified the temple, and they cleaned the temple, and they engaged in the work of the temple, and they lit the candles, and... But there's no searching for a flask of oil. There's no impure oil that they have to find. Right? They lit candles, so they did everything else. They purified the temple, and they cleaned the temple. And they lit candles. And then they celebrate. And you have to, the obvious question is, where's the miracle of the oil? And that's, many a quill has been blunted over the question of where the miracle of the oil is in the Al Hanisim story. But beyond the Nes Pach Hashem, there are other differences here that are worthy of note. And this summary you have on this other color page, that's a separate page. For example, what is the historical background? What leads us into the story? So whereas in the Gemara and Shabbos, what led us into the story was... In the Gemara and Shabbos, what led us into the story was... the search, the challenge of finding a flask of pure oil. What leads us into the story here? What's the historical background here? The conflict. Right? The conflict with the situation in Eretz Yisrael, the situation of the Syrian Greeks, not letting us observe the mitzvot, not letting us come into to observe the Torah, all of the decrees that Antiochus had fixed against us to prevent us from being able to perform mitzvot, challenged not to be able to observe Shabbos and not to be able to observe the laws of purity and not to be able to observe the laws of the temple and to defile the temple. We know all the stories. If you took this Alanisim and you matched it to the Book of the Maccabees, more or less, first Book of the Maccabees, this all discussed, aren't you familiar at all with the Book of the Maccabees? More or less, and the story of the Book of the Maccabees? And the Book of the Maccabees is part of what this is a good time to take a parenthetical aside. Talk about the Book of the Maccabees for 2 minutes and then park it. The Book of the Maccabees is a work that is part of what we call Sfarim Chitzoniim, the Apocrypha, or the outside books, meaning books that appear written by Jews, for Jews, at the time of the Second Temple period mostly, and that were excluded from the canon of the Bible. So they were intentionally excluded from the canon of Sifrei Kodesh. They are not Kodesh, they're not part of Tanakh. They were intentionally left out, hence they are called Sfarim Chitzoniim, or Apocrypha, the external books. For all kinds of interesting reasons, they were preserved, but not by us. They were preserved in the Christian Bible. So they do appear in the Christian version of the quote-unquote Old Testament, because they appear there in some form. They're probably originally written in Hebrew. The original Hebrew doesn't exist. What we have as a Hebrew text is a translation, just as the English text is a translation. Both are translations from the Greek. The only existing version that we have comes originally from the Christian Bible and is written originally in Greek.
Who wrote it?
That's also a matter of great controversy. We don't know. Certainly not by the Hashmonim themselves, certainly written in hindsight of a generation or two later. How many generations later is unclear, depends on which. And there are five books of the Maccabees. And generally speaking, the only one of the five books of the Maccabees, they repeat the story. Each five books tells a different part of the story. At least the first two are historical in nature. They tell the story, but they repeat, they tell the whole story, two different versions. Most scholars agree that really only the first book of the Maccabees has significant historical value. And the other two are probably of lesser significance. Nobody's quite sure when they were written or by whom. The other books take us into a later period of time and are generally speaking, what most people are familiar with if they read it is the first book of the Maccabees, or the first and second. The Rishonim did not read it. It's pretty clear the Rishonim did not read it. They didn't have it. If they had it, they only had the Greek version of it. And so the Rishonim don't really spend a lot of time engaging in the conversation about the Book of the Maccabees. It is, however, interesting. It's a fascinating work. And for historical value, it's worth a read, at least the first book. It's heavy to get through, but it's worth a read. But what we know from the Book of the Maccabees, more or less, can be summed up in this Alanism. What you've got here, more or less, is a very concise one-paragraph summary of the Book of the Maccabees. Time frame? Bimei Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Hashmonai Yuvanav. Malchut Yavan stood up against Israel, considered the evil empire. Shandam Malchut Yavan Arisha'a tried to destroy Torah, tried to force us against the practices of the Torah. L'avidam u'chakeret zanecha, and you and your great mercy provided us with victory. Amad talahem, you stood up to against them. Notice the phraseology of the word amad. Amda machut yavan harisha'a, the Greek empire stood against us. Who stood against the empire? Who stood against the Greeks? No. In the text. You, God, stood up for them at the time of their distress. The word Amad, the root Amad, appears in the context of the conflict between the kingdom of Yavan and the kingdom of God. Yavan stood against us, Malchut Shamda, Malchut Yavan HaRishal, Amchai Yisrael, and you, in defense of Israel, stood against the Yavanim, Amadat Alehem Be'et Tzaratam. That language, we'll see why that is significant in a few moments. You fought their battles, you took their vengeance, right? It's all about what God did to protect us, to engage with the Greeks. Almost the actual battle here is less described as much as the victory ascribed to God is described. If that make any English sense. Okay? What else do we have here? We have the historical background, we have the challenge, the mitzukah, the distress here, which is not about finding oil, but about fundamental issues of religious persecution. The great victory attributed solely attributed to God. time frame, and of course the root of Amad. Where life gets particularly interesting is in the Rambam. What the Rambam does, and the reason why this is all in color, is because what the Rambam does is, well, I'll show you what the Rambam does. Let's do this. Let's read it together. You have it on the source page, source 4, in Hebrew and in English. And I'm going to look at it here and read it through with you. Bayit Sheni. Kishemalchei Yavan gazru gzerot al Yisrael, when the Greek kings decreed religious persecution decrees against Israel, bitlud datam, tried to destroy their law, nullify their faith, v'lo enichu otam lasok b'torah or b'mitzvot, not letting them engage in the study of Torah or the performance of mitzvot, pashtu yadam b'mamonam uvivnotehem, they extended their hands against the property of Israel, against the daughters of Israel. V'nichnesu lehechal, they entered into the sanctuary. Partzubo pratzot, and they broke the boundaries. Timua teharot, they purified that which was impure. They made impure that which was pure. Tzar lehem liYisrael ma'od mipnehem, Israel was greatly distressed, suffered greatly because of them. V'lachatzum lachatz gadol, great oppression. Ad shenichem aleihem Elokei avoteinu, until our God had compassion over us. Voshi'am mi'adam, saved them, delivered them from their hands. V'tzilam, saved them. V'gavru b'nei chashmonai ha'kohanim ha'gdolim, the sons of the Chashmonaim, the high priests, overcame them. V'hargum, and slew them. Voshiu Yisrael mi'adam, and saved Israel from their hands. V'hemidu melech min ha'kohanim, they established a king from amongst the priests. V'chazra malchut l'Yisrael yeter al matayim shana ad ha'churban ha'sheni, restoring Jewish sovereignty and monarchy to the land of Israel, to the Jewish people, for more than 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple. That's the line that I quoted in my drasha this past Shabbos that we're going to come back to and spend some time discussing tonight. That's halacha aleph. Halacha bet. U'kishegavru Yisrael al oivehem, when Israel overcame their enemies, v'ibdum, destroyed them, b'chamisha v'esim b'chodesh kislevaya, it was on the 25th of Kislev, v'nichnesu lehechal, they entered into the sanctuary, v'lamatzu shemen tahor al ha'pachachad, they didn't find any oil except for one flask, v'lo haya b'ladlik al yom achad b'vad, it only could last for one day. V'idliku mimenu nerot ha'maracha, they lit from it the candles of the menorah, shmona yamim, for 8 days. Ad shekatshu zetim v'otziu shemen tahor, until they were able to make new pure oil. U'mipnei ze itkinu chachamim shebeoto ador shiu shmona hayamim ha'elu shetchilatan milel chamisha v'osim bekislev yimei simcha v'alel u'madlikim behen ha'nerot be'erev al pitchei abatim, and therefore our sages of that generation established 8 days of, from the 25th of Kislev, of days of joy and hallel and lighting of candles at our doors to our houses every night, mishmonat ha'leilot, leharot ulegalot hanes, to reveal and to publicize the miracle. V'yamim elu anikrim Chanukah, these days are called Chanukah. Ve'en asurim behesped v'taniyot kimei ha'purim, they are like Purim days in which eulogies and fasting is prohibited. Hadlakat ha'nerot behen mitzvah midivrei sofrim kikriyat ha'megillah, and the rabbinic mitzvah of lighting the candles parallel to reading the Megillah. So what do we have? So if you go through this text very carefully, and what I've done by color coding it is giving you the code to be able to to see it, you'll see that what the Rambam has done here is remarkable, because he has not based himself on either the Bavli source or the Masechet Sofrim source. What he's done, very remarkably, is he's merged them. He's combined them not only historically, but textually, in language. He's pulled phrases from both versions, and he's merged them together, and it's a fascinating read. For example, the date, 25th of Kislev, that appears in the Talmud in the Masechet Shabbat, appears nowhere in the Al HaNisim. But the Rambam very clearly inserts the date, B'chamishavis in B'chodesh Kislev. Shenichnesu leheichal, when they entered into the temple, they defiled it. The Greeks entered into the temple and defiled it. Where in the Al HaNisim does it talk about the Greeks entering into the temple and defiling the temple? It's not, because the Al HaNisim isn't about the oil, it's about the battle. So the issue of the defiling of the temple is not there, but it is in the Rambam.
It says, Shenichnesu yevanim leheichal tamu.
Right, in the Gemara and Shabbos.
Right.
But not in the Al HaNisim. Am I wrong?
This is the Tiarut Mikdashecha, but it doesn't emphasize...
Right, there's no reference to the defiling of the temple. Where here, Nichnesu Lehech, when we're talking about the Greeks and how they oppressed Israel, included in the oppression of Israel, which is in the Al HaNisim, is the reference to Nichnesu Lehechal, V'timu ha-terot, the defiling of the temple, which is a phrase that comes straight from Gemara and Shabbat. Or the reference to Malchut Beit Chashmonai. And you have a reference to Malchut Beit Chashmonai in the Gemara and Shabbos, but it's almost like hidden. Right? When the and the truth of the matter is that they went into but the story of the Pach HaShemem, the story of the oil, they weren't yet a malchus, they weren't yet a kingdom. They were who had fought on the battlefield. But you have the reference to Malchut very clearly in the language of the Rambam. Chazra Malchut ve'emidu melech mi'Yisrael ve'chazra Malchut li'Yisrael yetar matayim shana. The whole Pach HaShemen phraseology, lo matzu ala pach achad shel shemen ve'lo yabad ladlik yom achad. All of that is here. The language is identical. But you also have all the language of Al HaNisim. You have the phrase, right? B'tzalem, Boshiam, Chuot, Amad. I'll come back to the phrase Amad in a moment. They Oske Toratecha, they wanted to involve themselves, Lasok Batarah, and you wouldn't let them engage in the study of Torah. You made, for Israel, you brought around great Shu'ah, great salvation and victory, Hoshio Yisomi Adam. Vedliku Nerot Pachatzot Kodshecha, Vedliku Nerot Amaracha. So what the Rambam has done is he's taken the story of the rebellion, the story of the revolt, the story of the Chashmonaim, as it appears in the Al HaNisim text based on this Masechet Sofrim. And he's merged it with the story of the Nes Pach HaShemen. And that's the full picture that we are so... When we talk about Hanukkah, that's the story we relay. We relay the battle, and we relay... the Nes of the Pach HaShemen. We do both. But we can only do both because the Rambam put these two sources together. If I didn't have the Rambam to put them together, I'd have two different versions of Hanukkah that have almost no connection between them. And so when we look at, this is just a summary of what we just went through now, which is all of the pieces of the story. But what I wanted to also point out here is that the Rambam does one other thing, and I don't think it's an accident, is he borrows a word that the Al HaNisim used very specifically, and he modifies it. The word Amad in the Al HaNisim referred to you, God, standing for Israel against the Greeks, because the Greeks stood against Israel. Shamda machut Yavan amadat alehem be'etzarata. So the battle is between
the
Greeks and God, right? It's two worlds. God is, this is all God-centered. God is doing everything here. Even in the Alanisim, there's very little attributed to the Hashmonaim themselves. There's a time frame attributed to the Hashmonaim. Yimei Matityahu. But who's leading the battle? God. Who fought their fight? God. Who handed over the many into the hand of the few, the wicked into the hands of the righteous, the pure into the impure into the hands of the pure? God. Who fought our battles, judged our judges, avenged our vengeance? God. Amadat alehem be'et tzaratam. You stood for them in the time of their distress. All about what God did to protect us. Now, I understand the theology behind that. This is a prayer. This is Alanisim. This is Hodah. We're giving thanks to God for his role. But there's, if you were to look carefully at this text and tell me what role did the Kohen Gadol play, what role did the Hashmonaim play in this story as it appears in the Alanisim, what would you tell me? What role does the Kohen play? In the Gemara and Shabbos, their role is to seal the oil. In the Alanisim, what role do they play? Who cleaned up the Beit HaMikdash? What does it say? V'yachakein ba'u. What's fourth line from the end of the Alanisim? What does it say? Who came into the temple and cleaned it up? Who cleaned up the temple? Banecha. Who does Banecha refer to? B'nei Israel. Anybody, right? All of Israel. V'yachakein ba'u v'necha li'dvir beitecha v'timu techalecha v'terut mikdashecha. Israel, the Jewish people, your people. Your children. Doesn't say anything about the Kohen.
This is Matityahu, that he was Kohen Gadol.
All it says is, in the days of Matityahu, Ben Yochanan, and Kohen Gadol. That's like saying, Vayi b'imei, I don't know, some king or another. In the days of Yochanan, and Kohen Gadol. The days of Matityahu, in the days of Yochanan, in the days of Elazar, in the days of Vayi b'imei Achashverosh. It doesn't tell us anything. What role do the Kohanim play? It doesn't even say that.
True.
None. Right? It's a time frame. And the emphasis is all on God. Amadat alehem be'et zaratam. Dante et dinam, rafte et divam, etc., etc. What does the Rambam do? Rambam's language is remarkable. Because the Rambam very carefully and very loyally borrows the language of the Gemara and Shabbos and merges it with the language of the Alanisim to create a text and a story that reflects all the values of both texts with one addition, one change. Vehitzilam, v'gavru, b'nei chashmonai ha-kohanim ha-gdolim, v'hargum. Who led the battle? Who was victorious? The chashmonaim against the Greeks. V'oshiu Yisrael miyadam. They saved, who saved Israel? Chashmonaim. With God's help. But they, the Chashmonaim, v'he'emidu, who's the subject of the verb? They established.
Chashmonaim.
He'emidu melech min ha'kohanim. And they established a kingdom dynasty from amongst the Kohanim.
That
I guarantee you is in neither source.
That was a problem.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about. For the Rambam, it wasn't a problem. It wasn't a problem at all. It was absolutely mandated, and it was praiseworthy, and it was the subject of this discussion. says very clearly, Emidu Melech Min HaKohanim. And not only did they establish a kingdom, we reestablished Jewish sovereignty. We reestablished Malchut Yisrael. We reestablished the kingdom of Israel. There's nothing greater than establishing the kingdom of Israel. And we had kingship, we had sovereignty for 200 years, Yeterah Mataim Shana, until the destruction of the temple. 200 years of Jewish sovereignty we achieved through Hanukkah. Nothing more and nothing less. The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel to the Jewish people for 200 years. And the Rambam was well versed in the history of those 200 years.
Didn't matter.
Because we know the story, we know the history. History is well known. With all of the civil wars and all of the issues of the Hashmonean dynasties and all of the challenges they had and all of the, and Herod the Great, and all, it's all part of the 200 years. The Rambam knew it all.
But the Romans leaving out.
Hang on a second. Yes, you.
What about the occupation by the Romans? He counts that as sovereignty?
No, no. The Romans is the. You mean before the destruction? Yes. Yes. Because we still have a Jewish king. Maybe under the influence of a foreign power, but a Jewish king under the influence of a foreign power is still a Jewish king. A remarkable passage. But we can't. I can't overstate the importance of this line. The Rambam places this line before the story of the miracle of the oil. The lasting legacy of Hanukkah to the Rambam was the establishment of Jewish sovereignty by the Kohanim. So it's almost as if you, in the Ella Nisim, God fought our battles against the Greeks. In the Rambam, God fought our battles by enabling the Hashmonaim to fight our battles and to establish Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. Completely different picture. But that's the Rambam. And in the remaining time we have this evening, what I want to do is I want to walk you through why I think this reference to the Rambam is so powerful. Because the Rambam knew full well. Are there any questions on this? Because I'm going to turn this off now. If we have them. Yeah.
The only thing is that what I would say is what we consider to be sort of the heart text of the Aramaic, what we say. The emphasis on the imbalance of power between the Hashmonaim and the Greeks, which is what makes it really God versus the Greeks, because essentially the odds of the Hashmonaim were so minuscule that essentially it really wasn't their fight. They were just a vehicle. The Rambam completely leaves that out.
Correct. Because the Rambam
he can't include that.
Why can't he include that?
Because that would completely underscore the success of the Hashmonaim.
Correct.
The Rambam is looking for the historicity of it,
but more importantly, he's looking to reconnect us with what the Hashmonaim did. And they established Jewish sovereignty. We can't escape the fact that the end of the story is that they established a Jewish king. And they had for Jewish. Remember, when they come back from the temple, when they come back to the land of Israel and rebuild the second temple, they do not have sovereignty. They're under Persian occupation, under Persian rule. And then when the Greeks conquer the Persians, they're now under Greek rule. They have never enjoyed sovereignty, real sovereignty, since they were lost the kingdom of Tzidkiyahu to Nebuchadnezzar 400 or so years earlier. They've been living in the land of Israel, they've had a temple in the land of Israel, but they've had no sovereignty in the land of Israel. The Rambam, do not take away the victory of the Hashmonaim, their battle victory, and their political victory. They created Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. They got rid of the Greek occupation and established Malchut Yisrael. That's the story of Hanukkah, nothing more, nothing less. And the Nesh Pach Hashem is part of it. I tell you now, the vort that you're going to hear from my daughter on Shabbos, just because it's relevant. Okay? What you're going to hear from my daughter on Shabbos is the Nes Pach Hashem is not in the Ella Nisim, and it's not on, but it isn't the Rambam, but it's not in the Book of the Maccabees. What happened to this Nes Pach Hashem? I don't think the Nes Pach Hashem is the reason we have 8 days of Hanukkah. The reason we have 8 days of Hanukkah in the Book of the Maccabees is clear. The Rambam says it, and Ella Nisim say it, because they dedicated the temple. When you dedicate the temple, you need an 8-day program. It's the way it is in the Chumash. It's the way it is in Beis HaMikdash. They needed a 7-day and an 8-day day of revelation. You had it by the Mishkan. You had it by the Beis HaMikdash. When you rebuild the temple and rededicate the temple, you need 8 days. Agreed?
Yes.
So they were celebrating the dedication of the temple for 8 days. You can't have a dedication of the temple without lighting candles. Right? So they lit candles. Problem was, it was only one flask of oil. And the oil kept growing in order to allow them to light the oil so they could have 8 days of a celebration. We don't have 8 days of Hanukkah because we have because the miracle of the oil lasted for 8 days. The miracle of the oil lasting for 8 days was because we had 8 days of Hanukkah. Right. You understand why it's backwards. Okay. You had a question. To some extent, that's a little bit of a modern piece of it, but the Rambam was well versed in the fact that the Hashmonaim very quickly degenerate into a corrupt leadership sect. Whether it's because they were Kohanim and combined Kohuna and Malchus in and of itself, I would argue yes, but I don't even think that's. You know, if you look at the sources both in the Gemara and in the Rishonim as to what the problem was with Malchut Beit Chashmonai, it almost reads like we have, and Rambam as well, we have a promise of a kingship that has to go to David and David's descendants. And if you establish a kingdom that's not from David, you have a problem. The problem with the Chashmonim, it's actually two sources in the Yerushalmi. If you take a quick glance at source 21. Here's where we're going to kind of jump around a little bit. I'm going to turn this off because we don't need the rest of this. That will allow me to stop yelling. Oh, that sounds much better. If you look at source 21, you'll see that the Yerushalmi raises this question of what is the status of non-based David kings not from the house of David. Says the Yerushalmi, Ein Moshchin Kohanim Melachim, you may not anoint Kohanim as kings. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Antundarya Al Shem, why not? Because it says, Lo Yasur Shevet Miyuda, because it says in Yaakov's brachos to his children that the scepter shall not depart from Judah. The tribal leadership has to be from Judah. Rabbi Chiya Bar Ada gave a different explanation, which is, L'man yirich yamim al mamlachto, hu uvanav, Pasuk in Tvarim says, you will appoint a king from amongst your brethren, will have establishment of a long dynasty of kings. Immediately following, it says, lo yela kohanim aleviim chelek v'nachala, etc., that the kohanim can't have a portion in the land of Israel. Just connecting these two verses, you can appoint a king, you just can't appoint a kohen as a king. These two interpretations present a very different picture as to what the issues are. The first interpretation says you can't appoint Kohanim as kings. Why not?
Has to be from
Judah and then eventually from the house of David. Yeah. The second interpretation says you can't appoint Kohanim as kings because the Torah says you can't appoint Kohanim as kings. Ostensibly because, let's call it division, separation of powers, etc. There's two different pictures here. What the issues of Malchut Beit Chashmonai were halachically was either that they weren't from the house of David or that they were a Kohanim. But those are two different problems. And the Rishonim emphasizes one or the other. So, for example, it's a very famous passage of the Ramban, Nachmanides, in Chumash, in Breishit, where he talks on this pasuk of Lo Yasur Shevet Miyuda, where he criticizes the Chashmonaim for having usurped the kingdom from the legitimate seed of David dynasty. And it's actually source 22. And he says that in the bold print in the middle of the page, this was the punishment for the Chashmonaim who took kingship in the Second Temple period. Initially, they were great pious people. Had it not been for the Chashmonaim, Torah would have been forgotten. Nonetheless, they were punished greatly. כי ארבעת בני חשמונאי הזקן החסידים המולכים זה אחר זה עם כל גבורתם והצלחתם נפלו ביד אויביהם בחרב. The four sons of Matityahu, with all of their greatness, with all of their warring talents, with all of their divine providence, all four of them died on the battlefield. And the Gemara goes on to talk about what happened in the rest of the kingdom, and the rest of the Chashmonaim, and eventually the Edomites came, and the Romans came, and this was not a... It was a 200-year dynasty that was fought with civil wars. Hercules Navistabilis was fought with execution of the sages. They were kings amongst the Hashmonaim, were literally executed, all of the rabbis at the time of various periods of history. There was more internal fighting. There was more antagonism to Torah and mitzvahs. There was more conflict internal to the Jewish people during the period of the Hasmonean dynasty than almost any other period in Jewish history. Not a pretty picture. Either because they were Kohanim and they combined Kohuna and Malchus, or because they weren't Beit David. Either way, says Ramban, this was not a happy picture. But the Rambam, knowing full well how corrupt they were, how do I know he knew that how corrupt they were? He says so. I'll give you a couple of very brief examples. Source 26. Actually, I had two examples. I took one out. But I'll show you one example. This is in the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah. And the Rambam writes, "Klalu etzleinu shekohen gadol lo yiyeh b'anshei doro min hakohanim yoter mushlam mimenu b'chochma u'b'yira b'noi b'osher b'koach." We have a general rule that the Kohen Gadol has to be amongst his brethren of the Kohanim. He has to be the wisest, the smartest, the greatest, most pious, the wealthiest, the strongest. Alamilas, as they say. Agadol me'achav, greater than his brethren. Uba b'kabbalah shehe gadol mehem b'noi b'koach b'osher b'koach. V'im lo haya mimenu mekabtzim מממון הכהנים ונותנים לו עד שיהיה עשיר מכל אדם אחר אמר השם הגדול מאחיו שיגדלוהו אחד. Alright, he has to be wealthier than all the other Kohanim, not therefore susceptible to bribes. Time of the second temple, they took that to a different direction. אבל במקדש שני, says the Rambam, in the second temple period, היו בו כל העניינים בלתי מושלמים. None of this went well. None of this worked well. The kings didn't go according to the proper Masoret. They fixed the Kohen Gadol appointment. They fixed it by power. They fixed it by money. They bought it. Even if they weren't worthy. ועליהם אפשר לומר שמה לא למד אותו, משום כך נקרא הלשכה של דרים בכהנים גדולים, לשכת פרהדרין. It's a whole discussion about where this comes from. He says, we know what they were doing. They were buying the kuhuna, they were forcing their way into the kuhuna, they were killing each other to get the kohen gadol position, because these are kings, and the kings were corrupt. So the Rambam writes about the kings of the of Second Temple period. There were only Hashmonaim kings in the Second Temple period. There weren't any other kings in the Second Temple period. So was the Rambam aware of the corruption of the Hashmonean dynasty? Absolutely. 200 years takes us in the story of Hanukkah until the Churban. Literally till the Churban. Because the story of Hanukkah is in the year 165 BCE. The Churban takes place in the year 70. When the Rambam writes more than 200 years of sovereignty, he goes from the story of Hanukkah until the day the temple was destroyed. That takes us through all of the period of Herod the Great Executioner, who murdered people left, right, and center, who was an Edomite, wasn't even of Hashmonean dynasty of lineage, but he ruled as a sovereign king of Israel. He ruled as a Jewish king. It's part of Malchut Yisrael. It's a remarkable story.
Was he Jewish?
Also depends. Also debatable. But that's the point. That's what I wanted to get across. This was not a pretty picture. This was not a dynasty. This was not a kingship, historically. It started out great. But it wasn't a dynasty that we would really want to take pride in. Not something you want to write home about. But to the Rambam, it fulfilled one criteria. And that criteria was it was Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. And do not underestimate the power of what Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel means to the Jewish people. It's not even, and this is the mistake we make, it's not even because it's a prelude to redemption. So we have a perspective in modern history that we talk about in Meshitz Mechad Gulatenu, that our quote-unquote experiment with sovereignty is because we are a prelude to redemption, right? This is the first step towards redemption. The Rambam knew full well that the Hashmonean dynasty was not a prelude to redemption. How do I know that?
He was based on it.
Besides that, because the sentence that talks about Malchus ends with sovereignty was destroyed for 200 years until the destruction of the temple. So he knew clearly that this was not a prelude to redemption. This went the other direction. But until we reached the Churban, we had sovereignty. And do not take away the power, the religious, political significance of having sovereignty in the land of Israel. To the Rambam, and there's a whole book written about the Rambam's political or perspective on sort of state and politics and Malchus and what it means for the Rambam. I haven't read through it. I've read pieces of it and quotes from it. But the Rambam, this isn't the only place in the Rambam's writings where the Rambam inserts the value of sovereignty. An overarching value that we can't dismiss. The Rambam had a tendency to stick in the value of sovereignty in multiple halachas scattered throughout his writings whenever he could. And I'll give you a couple of very powerful examples, and with this we will kind of bring it to a close. Take a look back on. The Rambam also knew, by the way, that al pi halacha, you really needed a king from the house of David. The Rambam writes that very clearly. But he understood that if you don't have a king from the house of David, what's the alternative? Right? If the alternative is sovereignty but not from the house of David versus not sovereign versus occupied by a foreign power, you're better off having a king not from the house of David than having occupation and sovereign of control over by foreign power. That is clear to this whole discussion. Not everybody agreed with the Rambam. The Ramban certainly didn't. To the Rambam, this was axiomatic throughout his writings. I'll give you a couple of examples. Take a look on page 4. On source 11. The Rambam takes a phrase that appears in the Gemara about about the world, where the Gemara in Avodah Zarah in source 10 says, Olam kiminagon oheg, the world operates in accordance to its laws of nature, and idolatry is allowed to exist, says the Mishnah in Masechet Avodah Zarah, because people are creatures of free choice, and ultimately God is not going to take away our free choice. The Rambam uses that same phrase, Olam kiminagon oheg, to a different context. Yomot HaMashiach, he says, what is the nature of messianism? What are we driving for? What are we looking for in redemption? Olam HaZeh, it is this world. It's not supernatural. It's not a world of spiritual existence. It's here, earthly, worldly. This world is Yomot HaMashiach. Olam Kiminago Noheg, the Holech, the world operates by the laws of nature. Nothing in the laws of nature are going to change. The only thing that's going to change is one thing. Hamalchut tachzor liYisrael. Sovereignty will return to the Jewish people. That's what it's all about. Now, the Rambam had an understanding as to why. Why do I want Malchut Yisrael? What's the goal of Malchut Yisrael? And the Rambam says so clearly. He says the goal of having sovereignty is to enable the Jewish people to engage in Torah and mitzvot and the study of Torah on a national scale. He writes that in several places. If you go back a page, Source 7, Hilchos Tshuva, Mipnei Zeni Tavuka Yisrael Nevi'ehem Chachmehem Liyamot HaMashiach. Why did all of our peoples and our prophets and our sages yearn for the coming of the Messiah, for the day of Yamot HaMashiach? כדי שינוחו ממלכויות שאינן מניחות להן לעסוק בתורה ובמצוות כהוגן, so that we was no longer so that we should be free of the oppression of kingdoms and nations that wouldn't let us observe Torah and mitzvahs properly. וימצאו להם מרגוע וירבו בחוכמה, so that we can sit and enjoy and study Torah and engage in mitzvot and in spiritual life. That's what it's all about. That's what the goal of Malchut Yisrael is all about. And he writes this in a number of places. On the other hand, what is clear from the story of Hanukkah is that even if it's not ideal, even if we don't have those values accomplished and achieved in the context of Jewish sovereignty, and the Chashmonaim were certainly not ones to eventually, right, like 100 years later, the latter kings of the Chashmonaim were certainly not ones to promote the study of Torah, because to promote the study of Torah meant to promote the sages who taught Torah, and the latter kings of the Chashmonaim of the Chashmonaim actually executed the sages, so they weren't promoting the sages because they saw them as a threat to their power struggle. Nonetheless, sovereignty it still was, and that's the power of this whole discussion. I want to leave you with two quotes. One, actually, yeah, two more minutes. I'll come back to one. But if you take a look in Source 29, there's an article written by, at the time he was one of the Rebbeim in Shalavim. I'm not sure what he's doing yet, actually, at this point. His name is Avyol Katan. He lived in Shalavim at the time, and I knew him there. Sarek is a very famous, very well-known obstetrician in Israel. Avyol Katan wrote an article on exactly this subject. And in the last paragraph, he writes the following. In Source 29, I'll translate it as I read it. B'chol ofen barur lefi Rambam. Shagam malchut chalkit. It's clear, based on everything that I've shared with you in the Rambam, that even a partial sovereignty, gam malchut b'guma, even an imperfect sovereignty, gam malchut sheberosha rishei Yisrael, even if you have leading this sovereign nation, rishayim gemurim. I don't have a translate, rishayim gemurim, right? Rishayim gemurim. Afilu malchut shebemidazu or acheret kfufa l'shulton zar, even if it is to some extent subject to and the puppet regime of some foreign power, as Herod was to Rome. Shem malchut Yisrael aleha. It still has the name of Jewish sovereignty. Kol od lemaaseh hi sholetet mibchinot mesuyamot al ha'am ve'aretz. As long as it is Jewish sovereignty over the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And we have to be thankful to the Ribbono Shel Olam for its existence, lifachot mula alternativa, at least considering the alternative, which is shilton muchlat shel zarim al am Yisrael be'eretz Yisrael v'kavachomer bagalut, a foreign power subjugating our people in the land of Israel and certainly in the exile. So it's a fascinating read within the Rambam. And to the Rambam, that was the legacy of Hanukkah. So every time we light the candles, we have to think about the fact that how different lighting the candles is here in St. Louis versus lighting the candles in Israel, because it's about the celebration of Jewish sovereignty. So I'll leave you with two thoughts. Number one, to give credit to the Chashmonaim themselves, we have more information than the Rishonim did, because we have the text of the Book of the Maccabees. And the Rishonim didn't have access to that. But what's fascinating is when in the Book of the Maccabees, in the early generations of Matityahu's children, when they were offered leadership positions, and they took them to lead the people, it's fascinating in the language, at least in the translations that we have, the word melech is never used. We call it malchut. They didn't call it malchut. If you look on page 7, handful of examples. source 33, after the death of Yehuda. Achrei mot Yehuda achicha en kamocha ba'aretz. There's none like you in the land. I think this is a reference to Yonatan. Latzet v'lavo lefanenu latzineni mekaf b'koach yadam u'mikaf kol d'rshei ra'at amenu. Lachen bacharnu b'char liot l'rosh u'lenagid. A head, a leader. Source 34, l'nagid. Source 35, nasi. Every term you can imagine, except one. I think they understood that they weren't going to call themselves Melech. Later kings, later Hashmonaim kings did, clearly. But the early generations, I think, were sensitive to this distinction and didn't call them, they called themselves leaders in various ways, military leaders, political leaders. But the word Melech was reserved for the house of David, and they weren't going to do. In fact, I was particularly taken by source 36, which is Perek Yudalid. They appointed Shimon as their leader. Until the day that a Navi Emet shall come in Israel and do what? And reestablish Malchut Beit David. They knew that it was temporary, right? But that's the power of it. And that's really the legacy of the story of Hanukkah from the perspective of the Rambam, that the achievement of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was so powerful a moment that it was worthy of being preserved in the events of Hanukkah. I will leave you with one consideration and thought. Why is none of this in the Gemara and Shabbos? Gemara and Shabbos talks about lighting candles because of a miracle of an oil lamp lasting for 8 days. Why is none of this in the Gemara and Shabbos?
Well, the candles are the mitzvah.
It would be dangerous to put it in the
mitzvah. Dangerous to put in the mitzvah. The candles, why is the candles in the mitzvah? Why aren't we saying, why isn't it a celebration like Yom HaAtzmaut to celebrate Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel? That's a far greater accomplishment than the miracle of the oil. Far greater, and a far greater miracle to the Rambam. 500 years we've been waiting for Jewish sovereignty, we finally got it. A far greater accomplishment than the miracle of the oil. The miracle of the oil was there to give a divine stamp of approval to the work of the Chashmonaim. We're putting the cart before the horse. Why is none of this in the Gemara and Shabbos? I think there's a simple answer. Gemara says, uses the word, this I heard from one of my, from the Rosh Yeshiva, when I was in Shalavim. The Gemara uses the expression Lashana Acheret. The holiday was fixed Lashana Acheret. What does Lashana Acheret mean?
The next year,
right? It doesn't say the next year. It says some other year. I think this Gemara in the Bavli is all about the question of what remains of Hanukkah after the Churban. And that's the question, my Hanukkah. Because if Hanukkah was the Yom HaAtzmaut of the Second Temple period, if Hanukkah was the celebration of Jewish sovereignty, what do you do with a holiday that celebrates Jewish sovereignty after the sovereignty has been destroyed and the people have been exiled? 200 years later, you're sitting in Bavel. What are you celebrating Hanukkah for? Imagine, Chas V'Shalom, imagine for a moment that the state of Israel is destroyed and the people of Israel are scattered around the world. And it comes to Heir, would you celebrate it? Just a thought experiment for a second. Chas v'shalom, the state of Israel is wiped out. People of Israel are scattered. And the king and the state of Israel is destroyed. Heir, are you going to celebrate?
I think we would.
You think you would?
Yeah. No.
For what reason? What possible reason would you have?
You say Kaddish for a person you remember? You can say Kaddish or some kind.
You're going to say Challah?
No.
Okay.
More like
you're going to say Challah? More like Tisha B'Av. So Tisha B'Av, I understand. We turn Hei here into Tisha B'Av. I understand. Chas v'shal. What the Gemara's question is very powerful. The Gemara's question is very powerful. Post the Churban, my Chanukah, what's left? We're not celebrating sovereignty anymore. Malchut Yisrael is gone. What part of Hanukkah is still relevant? Why are we saying Hallel? That's the question. And the Gemara comes up with an answer. Because the miracle of divine providence is something worthy of celebration in all periods of time and in all places and in all diasporas and in all communities. And that message can resonate. The notion of divine providence, that God watches over his people, regardless whether you're in Israel or in diaspora, whether you're in sovereignty or not sovereignty, we can live with. So we can present a story, we can take a piece of the story that's relevant to the concept of divine providence, preserve it, celebrate it, and let it illuminate our lives. I buy it. That's what Gemara, that's what the sages in Bavel understood Hanukkah to be. Hanukkah today, I think, has a different meaning. So I think today, it resonates with the original intent that the Rambam had, which is that it's the celebration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. Hanukkah is a miracle.